This is Ben Smith. I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hello, people. Hope you're all doing okay. Ben here. This is episode 102 of A Small Voice podcast, which I'm very pleased to say features a chat I had with the Northern Irish photographer Hannah Starkey, who I shall introduce in a minute after some housekeeping and a couple of sponsor messages. If you do enjoy this podcast, you think it's worth the price of a cup of coffee per episode, then please do sign up for a small recurring monthly subscription, or if you prefer, make a larger occasional donation at bensmithphoto.com/asmallvoice. Do please leave a positive review on iTunes so that others may find out about it. And if you do need a new website but you can't face learning how to do it yourself, I will happily sort it all out for you using the Squarespace platform for a competitive rate. This episode is sponsored by Finder.me, F-I-N-D-R.me, which is a two-sided marketplace for imaging professionals, providing clients with direct access to thousands of experienced photographers on a single platform, and in turn introducing photographers to hundreds of potential clients. Finder connects photographers with relevant customers based on location and type of photography services offered. Photographers can sign up quickly and easily and for free for corporate contracts at fixed rates, or they can set their own pricing to attract direct clients. And in stark contrast to some of their larger competitors, the good people at Finder care about you, the photographer, and are committed to total transparency in the way that they do business. Finder is basically for everyone in the photography business, from wedding planners to artists. And if you are a photographer, regardless of whatever type of photographer you are, go and open an account, start filling out your profile, open up a whole new way of finding new work, finding new clients, and finding new opportunities. Join up for free at finder.me and get found. This episode is also brought to you by the Charcoal Book Club, the first and only book of the month club dedicated exclusively to photo books. Each month, Charcoal works with the most respected names in contemporary photography to select a first edition monograph that is a must-have for every collection. Each book arrives signed by the artist, along with a note card and a print from the guest curator, with free shipping to the US, Canada and the UK. Past curators have included Alex Soth, Mark Steinmetz, Andrea Modica, Todd Heider, Ron Jude and many others. All that, along with members-only pricing in their online bookstore and more, makes the Charcoal Book Club the best and most exciting way to stay up to date with essential work in contemporary photography. I just got back from 8 days in Montana, America, where I was a guest of the Charcoal Book Club at their Chico Hot Springs Portfolio Review event. I'll tell you more about it in a couple of weeks. Suffice for now to say it was amazing. I had a great time. The venue was special. I met some wonderful people, and I worked my butt off for you. I have 6 chats to bring you from the event, plus a special report. But all that is to come. For the time being, just to say, there are numerous people to thank for that experience. But let me just single out Jesse Lenz, Lindsay Metevier, and John Levitt for your all-round general awesomeness. And like I say, more to come on that in future episodes. In the meantime, quietly contemplative yet intensely evocative, Hannah Starkey's photographs explore the physical and psychological connections between the individual and her everyday urban surroundings. Since the beginning of her career, the artist has worked predominantly with women as her subjects, collaborating closely with actresses as well as anonymous acquaintances she meets on site to develop intricately textured scenes. Stark architectural backdrops and strong associations of colour and imagery heighten the sensation of her compositions on both a formal and associative level, triggering personal interpretations and a deeper mediation on the experience of the visual world at large. Born in Belfast in 1971, Hannah currently lives and works in London. She received a BA in photography and film from Napier University in Edinburgh in 1995 and an MA in photography from the Royal College of Art in London in 1997, the 3rd International Tokyo Photo Biennale's Award for Excellence and the St. James Group's Limited Photography Prize. In 2000, Hannah presented her first major solo exhibition at the Irish Museum of Modern Art in Dublin. Other important solo presentations include 29 pictures at the Mead Gallery at Warwick Arts Centre in Coventry, and Church of Light Altarpiece, a site-specific commission for St. Catherine Church in Frankfurt. Hannah's photographs are in the collections of the Tate in London, the Huis Marseille Museum for Photography in Amsterdam, the Seattle Art Museum, the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, the Irish Museum of Modern Art in Dublin, Museo d'Arte Contemporanea Castello di Rivoli in Turin, Italy. Oh, I'll do my best with these things. And Centraal Museum in Utrecht. And early this year, she had a major solo exhibition at the Tanya Bondacar Gallery in New York. So please do enjoy this chat I had with Hannah Starkey. What did you do your degree in?
I did my degree in photography, film and television.
Right.
It was a 4-year BA honours in Edinburgh at Napier University. It was a vocational course and you learned about everything within the first year, but mainly photography. And then by the time you got to third year, I think, or possibly second year, you specialised in either photography, film or television.
Mm.
And I specialised in photography because that's what interested me the most.
And is that what interested you going into the course right from the start? Or did you just get...
Yeah. Yeah, I went in with a photography portfolio from A-level photography. And that was what I really wanted to do, was study and become a photographer.
Mm.
But it was an added bonus to have... theoretical teaching and the history of film, and to some extent, well, moving image in general, also taught alongside stills or photography. So quite possibly one influenced the other, because my images are considered cinematic. And they do, they play off associations with cinema and the narrative within cinema, so...
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean...
a lot of cross-pollination.
Yeah. Well, people talk about that constantly with your work, that it's very cinematic. And I was wondering, whether cinema was an influence and whether you were into certain directors and that kind of thing, as you kind of went through your degree and even before that.
Yeah, well, possibly. I mean, I was exposed to, the history of cinema. So we would be showing clips of great films from that history. But also we were very close to a few of the independent cinemas in Edinburgh. One was the Cameo and the other one was Edinburgh Film House. And they were art house films. They showed mainly art house films. So I think I was probably around thinking about film and studying in Edinburgh when Reservoir Dogs came out. But it certainly opened my understanding of the power of cinema. I mean, before that, I'd really only seen films on TV.
Yeah.
Very rarely in cinema. And the films that I saw on TV by accident were probably the most influential. You know, when you're stuck with three channels, four channels,
yeah,
and you have to watch a Laurel and Hardy film or you have to watch a Harold Lloyd or right through to, I remember seeing Come See by a Russian director whose name escapes me right now. Do you know the film I'm talking about?
No, I can look it up and kind of make a note of it.
It's not Tarkovsky. But really profound Russian film about Second World War and partisans' activity in the Second World War. But it was so beautifully shot. And I just thought, when I was maybe about 15, completely out of context, it was on late at night on BBC somewhere. And it's a film that just blew my mind at that really receptive age and kind of continues to interest me, the visual, the cinematography, the kind of weaving narrative in with images. I think that was a real moment for me that was caught totally by accident. Cinema has always been there. I'm always interested in narrative because I grew up with narrative, different forms of narrative, from religion to a sort of paganism, if you like, sort of coming from the Celts and the influence of the Celts and all the stories that came from the mythologies and the stories that came from that sort of history background. Just oral histories as well, you know. And I think narrative and storytelling is the sort of the basics, the fundamental in human development. And, you know, I think it's probably what's propelled our evolution is our ability to make narratives and to share narratatives and to learn from them. So the fact that I'm working in photography, which is a very democratic, everyone understands the language and has access to it, and within that, telling stories, it makes the work very accessible, which is important because my audience is intended to be possibly anyone that comes across the images, anyone that's interested in photography. It's not in any way wanting to be highbrow, because the whole point of it is it's constructed to talk about narrative, to tell some extent a kind of a female perspective with female figures in the frame. So it's really important to me that my 16-year-old teenage daughter gets what the image is about and is and it resonates with her in some way. It is accessible. So I think that's probably one of my main factors in photography, is that it's working in a medium that is so influential that we all partake in. And you can maybe learn how photography works or how images are constructed or the codes, signs, everything that's woven into an image that we see in terms of images on a daily basis, bombarded, whether it's social media or advertising or any of that kind of thing. And what strikes me really, that's really amazing, is that we understand an image in something like 13 millionth of a second. The process is so fast that we don't even consciously think about it. But yet the influence of these images and the subliminal influence just by their omnipresence in our lives and our visual culture is something that I think we need to think about more. So constructing an image, a slow image, an image that's confines the eye in some way or intrigues the eye and then leads into a more contemplative, longer relationship with the image and working out what it means, feeds back into hopefully how particularly women and young women think about the images around them. And the effects, or how they're constructed and why they're constructed in that way and what the psychology is behind them, and the fabricated nature of particularly advertising images to sell ideals.
It's interesting to hear you say that, you know, they're not intended to be highbrow, because, you know, as someone who's very much sort of considered to be an artist, you know, in the process of kind of prepping for this interview, you know, I was reading a lot of description of your work, you know, which employs that kind of language of art criticism, and frankly, I find it pretentious and slightly annoying, and in a way, it kind of obfuscates rather than actually serving to clarify anything, I feel. And I know that, you know, that language is part of the, you know, landscape, and that there are people who are, you know, paid to, you know, use that kind of
absolutely, but it's a language.
But it just interests me to hear you say that, you know, for you is that you don't think of it as a highbrow thing.
No, and I suppose also for me, because I am much more picture based, much more visual than word based, that the very reason that I don't title my images apart from the date and the year is because I am working to communicate in images, in a visual language, that I am kind of fluent in. And so, you know, interestingly to me, it's great when it's kind of interpreted through language, through words by either critics or theorists or, you know, people who generally write about art. I find it really interesting how they decipher the image into that language. It's not my language, but it has a really important role to play because it educates me also about the image and where what its place is, whether it's in art history or contemporary art, contemporary photography. It's a really important dialogue for me. I don't think it's necessary to have to explain the images, but it's more their interpretation and what they can bring to the expanse of that photograph. Mm. It's really interesting to me. It is another language that we all learn. I think in a way to also be able to talk about your work and think about your work in a different way. So, you know, it is a good and a bad thing. It can kind of just seem like overblowing the image when it's already in there, but it also, for me, is important because it helps contextualize it and think about it in the various contexts that it's operating in. I don't necessarily think of myself as an art photographer as such. That's one sort of road that the work went down, but there are kind of many applications.
Yeah,
to the work that I do.
I mean, you've said that, you know, you're sort of trying to create a hybrid in a way of all the different methods or the different techniques or the different kind of areas that you learnt. So I presume you had quite a broad kind of
I talk about this education. Quite often because I particularly like that I had a broad education. I had a very vocational education, which meant that it was, you learned the history of photography and photographic theory, but it was really based on how are you going to earn a living as a photographer out in the world and what type of photographer do you want to be? Do you want to be a photojournalist, fashion, advertising, editorial, portrait, landscape, you know, there's so much. And I spent 4 years learning the language of each of these applications and how to do it. And for me, I kind of wanted to avoid categorization. It might be something to do with coming from Northern Ireland, or it might be something to do with being a woman at that time. But I felt that my freedom in the medium was being able to apply my language to different outlets rather than to follow the language already embedded in, say, photojournalism or fashion. Mm. I sort of wanted to put my perspective and the way I see the world into all these different outlets because that's, I think, where quite possibly it even has more influence in the commercial world than the fine art world. Mm. But what I learn from, and this is something I never expected, but it's very, very important to me, that going through a vocational course and then doing an MA at the Royal College, which is certainly when I was there, the last year that I was there, it became much more art theory led than practical or preparing you for industry. And for me, that was really good because it provided a very fertile ground to cross influence and to find this language from the different applications and the aspects of those applications that I had found most interesting. So to break it down in a very basic way, I find it interesting how advertising worked and the slickness of advertising, the language it was able to operate out of in a kind of real immediate way. And I think that's probably more visual than it is to do with maybe kind of deep thinking or deep meaning behind the work. Hello, I love advertising and some advertising is genius, you know, so seductive. But also, when I look at documentary, and I study documentary for a long time, there are aspects of it that I think are really important, like its ability to instigate social change, or its what I call emotional IQ, you know, how it can elicit an emotional response from the viewer, from something that is two-dimensional still and silent. And I think the power that it has in that context is really interesting. So, and I think for me, when I build images, among other things, what is very important is the emotional IQ, in that it is tender, it is, for me, empathetic, it is, how can I say this, it's not cold, cynical, and ironic, kind of post-postmodernist, it's the complete opposite. It's, for me, it's a form of solace, in a way, in response to all the other, not all the images, but a lot of the images that are circulated in the world representing women.
Well, I guess it seems like, in a way, you were a little bit ahead of your time, I think, because now those pigeonholes have kind of broken down a lot more. Have you noticed that happening? Have you felt that that's happened over the course of your career? Because you're talking about, you know, drawing on different influences, and I think when you had started doing that, it was probably much less common to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a wonderful thing, because you just get more intelligent photography out there in areas like fashion and advertising. And I also think that, you know, one thing that the Royal College proved to me at the degree show, and I produced these 7 or 8 pictures, I think there were, was that they attracted people from all different areas of the industry. So Mooring Paley from an art background, Saatchi & Saatchi
from your agent.
Advertising, yeah, she's my dealer. So some editorial, some reportage. So it was interesting to me at the degree show how the images were kind of seen by members of the industry as being able to apply to their needs, to their agenda. And that was very exciting to me, because it meant that the languages of photography was opening up. And with that, the kind of stereotypes in some way would begin to be diluted.
Yeah.
And I think that's exactly what happened. I worked with an amazing art director at the time when I first left college, who found me, Phil Bicker. And he was connected to ID and The Face, or one or the other, and really influential. And I think he was the one kind of driving that shift and that crossing over at the time. And from working with him, I worked on Vogue Homme and Nike's advert, Virgin advert, various things. But he, as the art director, could see how these images could have a different level of seduction and deliver a different type of message that was quite possibly either more attainable or more relatable or just smarter, you know. So working with him, and I probably did that maybe for about 4 or 5 years or something before he moved to the States, I learned a lot about the freedoms that you can have in photography, and as long as it's really good work, that it sort of transcends most of the barriers, most of the kind of narrow stereotypes. I think what Phil did was he just opened up a commercial space for a different type of photography that people really responded to. You know, when I did one, a Nike advert, that was one of the first Nike's adverts for women. It was a print advert, so it went into lots of women's magazines, and I think it had billboards as well. And it was kind of radical, actually, because I was trying to use models that were kind of closer to what normal women can identify with. It was all female. I think maybe that's why they went with me. and to kind of to find a language within advertising that could kind of relate more to the woman that might be walking past the billboard or flick through the magazine, engage her visual intelligence and enjoy all the different aspects of the image without feeling kind of lesser or it's not attainable or kind of depressed by this kind of perfection that's doesn't exist and is probably photoshopped. So I was trying to go for the real, kind of wrapped up in a kind of sort of more psychological truth, but with the seduction of advertising. And Phil Bicker was the really generous kind of art director that that allowed us to play with those ideas. And particularly with the Nike one, it had an unprecedented response from magazine editors who were mainly female. And I find that really interesting. This is really early at the beginning, but the fact that there was a market for these different types of images. But to be honest, I think it was a bit early. And also around about that time, raunch culture and lad culture was coming in, and it was really changing the value system again of images. And I think things just became a lot sexier and a lot more body conscious. And I think actually lots of photographers, lots of great fashion photographers and advertising photographers managed to carry on that language and kind of find a way through it that wasn't one extreme or the other. For me, I was having children. I had two young daughters, and I was teaching and making work for exhibitions. I was doing a lot, so it was very easy for me to let, you know, the advertising drop off, and I did slightly push it.
Well, I was going to say, you know, you're an example of someone who managed to straddle that brilliant line between doing your own personal practice, but also getting commercial work. Have you managed to maintain that, or have you not? You know, has that not necessarily been a priority for you to do?
Yeah, I love it.
Because a lot of people would love to do both those things. That's the dream, in a way.
And actually, it's really important to me to be able to do lots of those things, because the medium I love, and exercising it in all different scenarios, situations, is really interesting. You know, if it's editorial and you don't have very much time with that person and you've never met that person and maybe you've never seen the location. Yeah. It's terrifying, but it's a challenge, because you know you cannot come away without a picture, and there's always a picture to be found. So, and the flip side of that would be making work with the galleries that represent me, like Mooring or Tanya. You know, they give me time, they give me space, they nurture the work. So to be able to also then work commercially and immediacy, and to test my language and to test my talent to some extent and my relationship with photography, to see it going out into the public arena rather than the gallery or the museum arena, and how it attracts attention back is really interesting to me. You know, sometimes in an editorial you'll get sort of it coming from the very top and it filters down right through to the picture editor, of the really positive response to that image in the magazine. So say it might be for the FT Weekend, or where else would it be? It might be T Magazine in New York Times. Or, you know, they do tend to do, they sit off the page and they attract attention. And it's not coming from an egotistical way in my perspective that it's oh yeah, this is great and I'm amazing. It's not like that at all. It's me trying to find out, how do you break down this very narrow structure of maybe editorial or commercial portraiture, and kind of reconstruct that language into an image where it does all the things it's supposed to do. You can see the person, it kind of contextualizes the person in some way, but it engages the viewer. And obviously all photographers are trying to do this, And that's what's really interesting about being a photographer, I think, from a personal perspective, because I do make work in an art environment, and all the kind of art education and influence and understanding that comes with that. If it can feed back into my commercial work, it's doing what I wanted to do. It's kind of engaging the viewer in maybe slightly to massively different way, depends on the image. So I don't do commercial work or editorial things like that to kind of earn money as such, or to kind of then have a career in advertising, which is the most sane and logical reason why you would do this. I do it because it's a real challenge, and its immediacy and its art in the world is a balance for me.
Well, so I guess, you know, you can have an influence in some way, because people, as you say, are coming to you because they've seen your practice, your personal work, as it were, and that they're looking for you to bring something of that to,
absolutely.
It, rather than just, look, this is what we want, and, you know, this is what we want you to do, and this is how we want you to do it. It's much more of a kind of collaborative process in a way.
Yeah, I've never got that, actually. And I think maybe if I worked kind of more often as a commercial photographer, that would be my experience of it. But like you said, because, one job goes out into the world and it attracts something else back, that they know where I'm coming from, and they've already seen the work, that they've maybe already done that process before they've commissioned me. They've gone, right, what do we want this image to do? Who is it of? What do we want it to look like? The tone of it, the feel? And they go, okay, well, let's ask her, because she does something similar to that.
We know what
Possibly.
Hannah does.
I don't know what the process is before, but I can imagine that makes sense.
Yeah.
And then they just tell me, well, you know, just see what you come back with.
Mm.
And there doesn't seem to be very much pressure apart from the pressure that I put on myself. Because also, you know, when you're working commercially, it is a collaboration. And there are so many other important aspects at play, like budget, audience, who the person is, the brand, all those sort of things, that it sort of has to be a collaboration. And I'm very happy to compromise within commercial work, because it's important for me, for the client, to be happy as well. And that's generally how it goes. And I think it's maybe because there is that editing process before I'm even involved in it.
Hmm.
But, you know, the compromise between making work that's for a museum and a thing in that context, or making work that's maybe for a billboard or editorial, there is a commercial imperative that will always be there. So you have to work out how to make sure you don't lose that for the client, but maybe kind of operate in a different way. So on a really basic level, you're not doing kind of sex sells, so obviously, or beauty, or an idea of beauty sells. You know, you're kind of you're kind of released from that a bit to look at the nuances of the image around that. So I never, if I'm photographing commercially, I don't make scrutinizing images of people. I kind of put them in their environment. So it's kind of more engaging for the viewer, and you can see who the person is, but you can also learn a bit more about them.
But in terms of your own personal work, though, I mean, maybe you could just kind of give me a little flavor of the process, because obviously some of the listeners will be very familiar with it, some won't be, but essentially what you're best known for is pictures of women that you have constructed. You've cast it, as it were. You've hired the subject. But where does it start? Do you have an idea that you want to kind of work with, or is it just observing these moments in real life that you then go and kind of reconstruct? How does it normally work?
I think it's the same thing, actually. It's because photography as a medium seems so fluid to me, and I have my own language in it with my own troops, or the, you know, the my own kind of composition and what I look for in the world that I know would kind of photograph in a particular way. And I've also been working for 20 years, that there is no one formula, and there actually never has been. It's interesting kind of reading some of the responses to my work, that, you know, I've noticed that you can't tell everybody everything, because it would be just too much information. So I suppose when people are reading my work, there's a certain kind of narrowing down that's taken place, or it depends when that what work they're writing about, from what period in the last 20 years. I think at the beginning, I actually also, you know, being very kind of engaged in documentary photography, but, you know, quite shy, that it was very hard for me to do things like, you know, stick my camera in somebody's face and walk off. I felt the very least I could do is ask them, and that is the very least, actually. I engage so much more. So that was one of the propelling forces for making the initial imagery, to set up an image that everyone in it was comfortable with, and they knew what the agenda of the image was, and it was something familiar that we could all kind of relate to. But also it was coming from my eye as an artist and as a photographer and as a woman, just being in the world and observing these scenarios that sort of take place. If you're sitting on the, I just remember as a student, just sitting on the top level of the bus and observing human interaction, that's probably what I do more than anything else, is just observe people. And, well, people watching. Everybody loves people mm-hmm. watching. We do it less now because we're film watching, but that's another thing.
Yeah.
So at that period, that's kind of what was motivating that work. And then as you kind of, you know, you continue in your journey through life, my case is a female photographer, and then you have daughters. I mean, it's all very particular to my life, what has molded my perception and perspective, and therefore the work. So, by the time I become a mum of young daughters, I began to see how they were bombarded with images, and how these images were articulating the female experience. So I began to look at how these images are externalized, as in the world around us, and then internalized. Also, as a woman, you know, woman, but it's kind of, I felt like I had no option but to cover this topic, because not only is it the longest revolution in history in terms of women's equality, and we have made amazing strides in the last century, 120 odd years, whatever, maybe 100, well, up until now. I began to see that our visual culture really undermines women, and really begins to undermine women from a very early age. And it's sort of thinking about that and processing it, and also looking at the history, not so much the history of art, but of photography, but the history of art, and seeing how little women played a role, and being an artist and knowing what it feels, how important it is to my identity to be able to go out and make work, and also for the work to be recognized. That, you know, when you're making work at the end of the 20th century and you look back at the history of, you know, whatever kind of discipline, whether it's science or art, and just how women were eradicated from the story and from history. And there's something about that that catches up with you as a woman as you're moving through life at certain periods. And you just can't deny the utter incomprehension of how something like this could happen. And I think for sometimes some of my work is processing that and then being able to visualize it in an image. So sometimes the images, they will be, how can I say this? They will be very ambiguous, and it will just be the female figure, and they will have a certain vibe, a certain kind of atmosphere to it, like the woman with the tattoo. And they're kind of trying to then begin to picture not an internal loss, but an internal kind of trying to reckon with all this understanding and information that I'm getting as a young woman and a woman of young daughters, trying to make a picture that kind of communicates that and resonates with other women in some ways. That solace, perhaps, or I wouldn't say sadness, but the kind of the loss of it, actually. So in that way, I think my images are quite tender and quite
it's such a sort of appropriate piece of fate that you ended up with two daughters, in a way, because you had already
radicalized, had no choice, believe me. I mean, there are a lot of other issues
but you made the decision to focus on women very early.
I did, actually, because I, you know, when I first came out of college and I made this degree show featuring women, I had kind of thought that I was making work. I've said this before on numerous occasions because it surprised me. I was working sort of from the documentary tradition, and I was making work about the human condition, and it amazed me how many times if you produce a series of pictures about women, it's about women, it's not about people. And at that stage I was thinking, well, if this being a picture with a group of men, would anybody have said, you know, so you're making work about male issues? And I suppose it was the discrepancy with being a female artist and the subject matter you can make work in, as being equal, as opposed to not being ghettoized or dismissed, or which it was kind of in the mid to late 90s. It was still very unpopular to be talking about feminist issues. And obviously there's a history of great female artists that, you know, thought, you will not tell me what to do, and continued and suffered to some extent if you look at generations before us. But it just seemed to me that there was all this kind of don't touch that subject matter, or when you look in the history, you know, that subject matter has been benigned. And I find, actually, what are you talking about? We live in a world where everything is seen through the male prism. Why would the female perspective not be important? And also, I've said this before, I'm from Northern Ireland, Belfast, you know, being politicized from a very early age. And I do smell a rat when people are a bit like, oh, no, you won't be doing that. That's not good. That kind of thing. I thought, well, you know, this feels like there's enough resistance that it's worth pushing through with it. And it's been really interesting over the last 20 years. And like I said, I'm only one in a lineage of women that have been working within these issues. And I'm only here because they have done this before me. You can even start with the Hackney Flashes, but, you know, all these works that have gone before are part of why I'm here. And my cohort, or my, you know, the women that I left the Royal College with and I'm still familiar with and are working and showing, that there is a connection to getting to the point where you do not need to talk about your gender, and you do not need to make this about your life's work. But until then, you just kind of have to make it your life's work.
You sort of said that you think that visual culture is the last battleground for women's equality and freedom. Can you kind of say a little more about that?
Yeah, I waited for a long time for it to change. It seemed to go backwards, sort of 2000, 2010. 2010, 2012 was the big, really intense time where everything was sold through the commodification of women's bodies in some way, whether it was pizza whatever, you know, gym membership. And I began to see the kind of the pornographication of that on top. So not only were we fetishizing women's bodies much more, it was kind of this hypersexualizing and this pressure to it was just really lazy advertising and photography. But in the times of recession, that you probably have to throw everything at it. Nobody seemed to have any other idea other than, you know, we will just, I don't know. I'm talking about particularly to women's products and advertising directed to women. Although I think something like 80% of the world's consumer population is women. So it's amazing that this language still goes on. But it just seemed to get sort of more narrow in its definition of gender and beauty, and you know, a woman's kind of sensuality and sexual agency. It seemed to be working against, even though I think a lot of it came out of the idea of sexual equality and women kind of wanting good sex and not having to wait for it. The 90s were a really interesting time. Yeah. And I started to notice on the high street, certainly at that time, that the photographers and the images that they were using for really kind of basic high street brands like H&M, or it was like no one was saying, what's the fallout of this? You know, what's how do these images affect women in the real world? You know, how are they being read? What are the messages in them? And what are they saying to younger women, particularly my case, daughters, who have their whole life ahead of them and do not want to be narrowed down so early into this, I would suggest, into this kind of this system of control that keeps telling women they are not good enough unless they subscribe to this very narrow ideal. So that really pissed me off for a long time. And I'm not the sort of photographer that will go out and make an image of a young woman. I don't know, maybe in a... I protect women with my camera. So I try to find another way of articulating this. And I really began to think, actually, this comes from numbers. It doesn't come from one artist or one photographer. It comes from, the only way you can change this culture is just sheer numbers. And I began to notice that there were a lot of women in photography education that weren't, I wasn't seeing them represented in the outside world. This was probably about 2012, I thought this. It was a really particular moment when I had two of my, a niece and nephew and my two daughters, and they maybe ranged from 10 till 14. And Miley Cyrus was on Wrecking Ball. And it was really interesting to me how this image of Miley Cyrus had been picked up by the press and then used as a selling device, which often happens. And I remember at that time just thinking, fuck this. The only thing that's going to change this is way more women being in photography. And I'm not saying that this is, you know, only the domain of men. It's a very small minority. But if they're going to be paid about $50 million a year and be doing big campaigns, it will not stop until somebody finds a different way of advertising to women. And bear in mind now we have Instagram, and that is mostly advertising.
And you're getting to experience all this through the eyes of your teenage daughters.
Absolutely. It was a very kind of small window that I could see how influential these images were, because they start maybe about 7 or 8. You know, it's even shocking to me that the news that I heard this morning on the radio about schools having to introduce sexual education in primary schools and relationship education and all those sort of things from the age of 4. And obviously they will do it really delicately. It won't be like the education you get as a secondary school teacher. But I think it's these are real warning bells that in some ways our visual culture is giving the wrong message, and boys and girls are equally suffering from this. You know, I find it heartbreaking when a 7 or 8 year old comments on their thighs or just says they don't like their body or their shape. And I think this is also something that it's so, you know, I've seen that build for probably from about 2010 till now, to the point where, you know, we can see boys and girls are having major problems with mental illnesses, stress, anxiety, low self-esteem, stuff that I didn't have as a teenager. I wasn't a perfect teenager, but I wasn't thinking about all this stuff. And I think almost in a way, if we can get, and it's really difficult to say this, but I have looked at the history of photography and it hasn't really changed, so something has to give, and we are in the new millennium. And there must be a reason why all these colleges are 80-90% female undergrads. And I'm not saying in any way they're all going to go out and do what I do or even photograph women, not at all. But the fact that they're all in there, that there will be some of them will think to themselves, I want to see the images. I don't see the images that I want to see in the world, so I'm going to make them. And that could be coming from many different sexualities, ethnicities, backgrounds. You know, it's kind of widening up our visual, popular visual, mainstream culture through the just the sheer flooding of other perceptions of the world or other experiences of the world. And I mean, that is really happening. I think in the last 5 years, you're seeing a dramatic shift in our visual culture. And I think actually what maybe happened was the images before that were kind of fairly basic, you know, they affected a whole generation. Then there's a new generation coming up that are counteracting that. And, you know, for me, if I was a young woman in photography starting out now, I would be very excited about the landscape. Mm. I'm very excited about my contribution to that.
Yeah, well, that's positive.
That was a big answer. I'm sorry.
No, it's good. I didn't want to interrupt because you're in full throw. I wanted to ask you about the influence of your own mum, because you grew up in Belfast in the 70s, basically, right? Mm. In the height of the Troubles. Mm. It was it must have been an extraordinary experience. How did that experience sort of influence, you know, who you then became, as it were? What kind of childhood did you have?
Well, you're not going to intimidate me, ever. And I think, actually, generally, Irish people are fairly irreverent.
Mm.
But I think, well, I've talked about this many times, because when you're born into something like that, and, you know, I was sort of born into the heart of it. I went to school in the poorest, most economically deprived part of Western Europe, and as an Irish Catholic in the north. But the remarkable thing was, being born into it, I didn't know any different.
Of course, yeah.
It's effect after. And I said this in a talk the other night, that I'm amazed how influenced I am by my early years. I mean, I was there until I was 18, 19, and then I went off to study. And it was a place that I loved. It's such a warm place, and it was very good to me. But I saw it all. You know, my mum kind of worked in the market. She had a little stall. Catholics didn't get jobs, so you had to be, either we were going to go on sort of government benefits, which was just never going to happen, my mum. So, you know, she kind of took her life into her own hands. But within kind of going to the markets, and this is, you know, this is a very, we went to some very economically deprived areas, both Catholics and Protestants, from I was about 4 till I left. And my mum was a very kind of warm, generous person, and she'd kind of she managed to lift people up. You know, she'd quite high standards for people and what she expected from them. And she was very well respected. But she, in the markets, she became sort of like a confidant or a social worker to women that, in an environment would have been too dangerous to be able to talk about what's going on, whether it's domestic violence or that kind of thing. And it, just her warmth in and her interest in it, her empathy, her compassion for particularly women that were caught in this violent conflict. There is a kind of parallel to what I do now in the fact that I go out into the street, and or whether I work with women who have caste or a stranger or that kind of thing, that there is still that parallel of instigating a conversation about their experience of being female. And women will always want to talk about this. And it's also for me to say, am I imagining this? Are young women having a really hard time? I mean, is it great? Am I kind of 47 and don't know what I'm talking about? Or, you know, just tell me your experience, because I feel this. And it amuses me, I only realized this, but it amuses me that, you know, 20, 30 years later, what my mum was doing in her capacity as working in the markets, I am doing the same way. I feel that our visual culture is almost an assault on women, depends what area you're talking about, but I think it's brutal. And it is trying to find that, am I right on this? And how can we communicate a tenderness between women so it can either, you know, photographer, break down the hierarchy that is then communicated out? And I think I must have learned that from my mother. I learned that from growing up in Belfast, where I saw women do amazing things, reach amazing heights. Never managed to bring through peace, but they were certainly important in kind of reconciliation and peace negotiation, and they still continue to be so in the world, the UN and resolutions and various things. So I grew up in a world where women instigated change. Women, you know, they put their head above the parapet and they risk things to have their voices heard on the basis of their belief in equality and peaceful upbringing for everybody's children, irrespective of religious background. I think also for me, because I am a woman, it's the commonality of experience. I'm jumping around here, but I realise we've fit all this in about 15 minutes.
That's fine. But like, would your mum have thought of herself as a feminist or sort of proto-feminist?
No, not at all. I don't think so. I mean, I that's another thing is, I mean, and it depends where you grew up in the world, but I kind of saw it in action, but didn't know the word for it. And then when I kind of came in to education and kind of learnt about how women had been historically thought of and treated, it was such a shock for me, because that wasn't my experience.
And so the women who were around, who you were around you and who you're influenced by, were sort of, without having that word associated with themselves, they were still acting, you know,
yeah,
or behaving
absolutely,
that way.
Absolutely. If they saw an injustice, they would call it out. And when I came to be kind of a fully paid-up member in the adult working world, I would just not tolerate any of those games or any of that hierarchical game-playing, or, you know, par games, aggressive competitiveness. I really was not interested in playing that because I don't need to. My work is very good, and if you behave like that with me, well, then that's your problem. It's not mine. And I would not want to work with that anyway. So I definitely saw the kind of end of the 90s, heading into the new millennium, that this system of which women had to operate out of, young women and kind of having to deal with abuses of power or sexual harassment on every level, you know, I just find it just so intolerable, and not a male issue really, a kind of more of a maybe a patriarch issue, a system that had been set up to kind of profit from the underrepresented. You know, it's a systematic failure that I was not ever going to be part of, or turn a blind eye to, or allow to happen to me. And of course, at some stages you get punished for that, because because you are representing a status quo or the change to that status quo. But again, coming from Northern Ireland, I always find that really interesting. I find it interesting why the system has to work like this, and also how the system has to change. And I think it is. I mean, it's really hard to know with the Me Too movement. On many level, in many respects, it's getting way better for women. They have their own agency. I think possibly with millennials and how they've grown up, that the idea of gender and, you know, very defined roles for men and women are collapsing, which makes it so much better for all of us, irrespective of, you know, if you're a man or a woman. I think that is coming through very strongly.
So you're sort of...
But we are at the tail end of the patriarch, and there will be a massive lash of the tail before it dies. Well, I think that's possibly what Trump is, and
Putin.
And, you know, these are kind of... These are really dangerous but exciting times.
So you're relatively optimistic for, you know, the sort of world that your daughters are going to come of age in terms of the progress?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, they're both biochemists.
Right.
So, and, you know, they're doing kind of A-levels.
So they're both into the same thing?
Yeah, remarkably. I mean, it's chemistry or science. It's very similar to art. And, you know, it's creative things. It's obviously... I think actually why they went into science was because they looked at the life of an artist. They saw how precarious it was.
Right, yeah.
How unstructured it was. All those things that I actually really value as a human being and working as an artist, the freedom, the idea nobody can tell you what to do or nobody can tell you what to work on or that kind of thing. And, you know, from them, from science, they want structure. Mm. And
yeah, so you didn't have to actively deter them from following your path.
No, absolutely, that could be their rebellion.
You know,
every generation or every child rebels against their parents in some way. That's very natural. As do they rebel against the photographers and artists that have gone before them. That's progress, I suspect. And yeah, they went in the right way. Thank God I wasn't a biochemist. But within that industry, you know, there has been sort of certainly sexism and, you know, it's a very male-dominated industry. And I hope that by the time they go to university and by the time they come out into the workplace, that it will be kind of an equal playing field for them. And what I do notice, and I think this is so important, because I remember as a young woman noticing the absence of women more than anything else. So if I was reading a text, it would be he before she, sometimes not she at all, or, you know, pronouns. And I think it's very hard to be what you cannot see across the board. And from my perspective, when I see my daughters kind of engaging in science and chemistry, and who's teaching it, and if they're watching tutorials, who's teaching it, and the fact that they're, or if they are looking at, there was one, I think it was Cambridge or it was Oxford that did a how to do a chemistry interview tutorial. And, you know, the numbers, the kind of, first of all, the interviewee was female, and the two interviewers, the three interviewers, two were female and one was male. And it was just so reassuring to see that being pictured, because that matters, that you can see yourself doing that role. And just with kind of looking at my daughters and their engagement with science, I think people are making a very conscious effort to make sure that women are seen as pioneers, as experts in their field, as authoritative in their field. And I those subtle shifts are really coming through, where to the point that they might not even think that they would, their gender would be discriminated against. Mm-hmm. Now, the other thing I hope for is that they get through without meeting a Weinstein would be great.
Yeah.
You know, and chances are they won't. Mm. And they are rare and in a minority. But they are there, and possibly in every industry. In fact, you know, every industry is tumbling as we speak. The art world have their own scandals, the photography world. And I really hope by the time that they get into the environment where they are going to produce their best work and work on sort of DNA and how we can have better lives or all those sort of things, that they're not taken out early by this kind of aggressive sexual harassment or, I mean, on a really basic level, they're not sent dick pics or they're not kind of have to fend their way out of a corner that they've been, you know, cornered into by some boss or something. You know, that it's all very clear that we are equal and these games not only shouldn't be tolerated but shouldn't even be played. Mm. They're so frowned upon. I think what's happened with the Me Too is that the silence has been broken, and I think for all of us, we're all kind of a bit shocked and willing to speak out. And it is the speaking out from both men and women that stop this culture from being allowed to continue.
Mm. We're definitely going in the right direction.
We all have daughters.
As you say, the chances of them having to deal with those scenarios are undoubtedly less than those.
But the problem, my problem is, and this is what I want to drive home. We were saying this 20 years ago. We're still saying it 20 years later. This has to be the point where we don't say it. We're not on a loop. We don't continue to say this in 2050, 2070. Right. I mean, I think the whole idea of gender will be completely different by then. But to really, really change things, and I think what's very exciting about the moment that we're all living in, and I know a moment is kind of, it seems like it goes like that, but for me it seems the right way of putting it, because it has to be a moment of just such sea change, such shock, such culture change, that it can't slip back.
Right.
Because I'm not even sure what it is, but there's the predatory nature of undermining a woman, particularly when she's young, is a really dangerous practice. As a young woman, it was very important to me how I was treated by men in my life, whether my dad or boyfriend or that kind of thing, because that helped my confidence. And I think if you have a visual culture that's kind of selling this idea that girls are sexual objects, or particularly young girls, the amount of kind of inappropriate older men I have seen come up to a young girl and not go away, it shocks me. It's like, get off them. You know, they have their own lives, and they're here to change the world. Do not scupper them at this early stage. And on the same hand, you know, the cosmetic industry, fashion industry, just back off. Stop telling them that they need to be perfect and then slap and Photoshop on it all. And stop telling them that their bodies are something they need to work on rather than they have. Or, I mean, both of my girls are national athletes and GB athletes. And you know, I see such a narrow range of body types sold to young women when you've been sold that a long time, it's very hard to rewire your brain into thinking, no, actually, this is a body type on its own. Or, and I'm not talking about my daughters in some respects, because they would kill me. But I went to a lecture the other day that was fantastic, and it was by a girl who had set up the Saggy Boobs app, I think it was, or not app, it might be a vlog, and I loved everything she said, because I have worked as a photographer in London, kind of moving through London with adverts, everything else, for 15, 20 years. I have seen these adverts come out of retouchers that I have been working off, retouch houses that I have been working with that are, say, on a really benign level, it might be Marks and Spencer's bra advert. Bra adverts used to be a particular way, and something happened, and it was probably does come from raunch culture and Photoshop, but these bra adverts, by the time this little guy in this dark room working with Photoshop had pushed these breasts around for about 2 weeks into these kind of ideal porn breasts that were then beamed all over the country in billboards and advertising Marks and Spencer's, just for Marks and Spencer's underwear. Marks and Spencer's underwear is really kind of tame.
Right, right.
Why were they suddenly kind of on the market of the pornographication of women's bodies? And it was just like a pair of breasts in a green bra. It was everywhere. And because I had been in this retouching house and seeing these things move from their original, which was absolutely fine, to these kind of hyper-perfected, enlarged kind of, you'd bounce off them and probably leave, you know, the stratosphere. And thinking about how kids on buses that pass these every day and boys on buses and what breasts mean to women and boys, it's a very basic kind of example. But, you know, you now end up in a situation where young women are having breast surgery, are possibly unhappy with their breasts because they're not equal size, or, you know, there's something about them that isn't symmetrical, or that, you know, they're not, because they're natural. And the thing that's not natural is the porno Marks and Spencer's Photoshop bra.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's only a small kind of...
Well, it's a good example, because it's example. As you say, it's a very sort of everyday kind of...
Yeah,
and it's, you know, it's and a kind I'm of seemingly in. Fairly benign, but it's the sort of thin end of the wedge.
Yeah, and I think it I think for young women, they kind of know this when they're going through photography education, and they're possibly thinking, not all, but they're thinking about this, and they're thinking about, well, you know, I'd like that money. That photographer got paid a lot of money. How could I do that? That would have as much impact, but would be my language that, and coming from my experience, what I bring to this image. How can I make this less surface, less kind of one-dimensional? How can I make it a better visual photographic experience for the viewer? That's what I'd like them to think about. Because there's so much money in it, and people are, I think, you know, advertisers and clients probably are desperate to see something else.
Yeah, something different.
As well, you know. It's just, how do you do it? And that's the most exciting thing.
Well, that's a good optimistic note to end on. Let's draw it to a close. What have you got on the cards in the near future in terms of your work?
I am, well... I'm completely consumed by one image at the minute. I went to I am not a protest photographer.
You went to the Women's
but
March?
But I've sort of become that. Well, I haven't become it. I've done it twice. And the Women's March was such an amazing turning point, and it was great to be there to photograph it. The day was like today. It was blue skies, warm winter. This last week, actually, I went to the... students protest, the primary school, the secondary school, the children and teenagers protest against climate change in Trafalgar Square. And so that's the second, I grew up with protests and people carrying placards, but anyway, that's the second one that I've been to recently in London. And I find it so overwhelming, the millennials and how passionate they were about this, and how many of them were taking photographs. So, you know, when you go into that environment and you're there for about 2 hours, and I always ask and I always give my card and all that sort of thing. There was one particular picture that I saw that it's such an epic but succinct picture about the time we live in, And the forces against us that we have to change, and how the younger generation are possibly, or maybe not actually, but certainly with social media and online, they are more politically active. And I think if I can get images out into the world that kind of depict this energy and empowerment's a tricky word, but this power that's coming from this next generation in one image, then that's kind of my drive. That's my motivations. And also, I'm working on a show for Mooring that's coming out 2020. That's a totally different way of thinking. When you start working on a show, it's all consuming. You don't even notice your children. You shouldn't even be driving, probably. You know, it's it is really all consuming. But I haven't gone there yet. What else am I working on? A few talks that I have to work on to try and articulate this all succinctly.
Right. Yeah.
You know, the thing that's very interesting to me about photography is it never stops. It's a continual learning process as the photographer. But also what you're asked to do as a photographer, whether it's kind of work on a commission, to write something, to curate, to do all those sort of things, it is amazing how you continually are asked to think about photography, whether you didn't want to or not, whether it pays or not. You're always there learning and thinking. And because I love the medium and I love the history of it and the evolution of it and the jumps that it takes, that I drink photography in, you know, all, you know, there's great sort of like websites like BJP or PhotoWorks or the Photographers Gallery, and then outside this country, there's loads of them. And I just drink them all in.
So you're just as passionate. You're fully, you know, engaged with it as much as ever.
Absolutely. And coming from a medium where people were kind of slightly disparaging that you could even do a degree in it.
Right.
You know, the fact that it is how we communicate, it is even way beyond whether it's art. You know, it is everything for us now. It is our currency. That it's a great thing to be totally and utterly engaged in and indulged in, seems to spring to mind. So,
well, that's also a lovely place to stop. So I just want to thank you for chatting. I've enjoyed it a lot, and it's been really fascinating to talk. And yeah, thanks for doing it, Hannah.
It's my pleasure. You were very easy to talk to.